And to me, you know, in my whole life, you know, I like a quote from Einstein. He said something to the effect, I don't know the quote, but he said something like, don't strive to be successful, strive to be able. Okay, and we've got it all wrong, because what we're taught is success equals value. Success equals, in the Calvinist tradition, which is really our culture, our culture is really heavily rooted in Calvinist and Presbyterian thought, which says if you are successful, and the Mormons say this too, if you are successful, then you are the beloved of God.
Right, that the one implies the other. And then how do you measure success, and what is success, right?
How many bedrooms are in the house? Very simple.
Right. I think that there's something to be said for how you were talking about how you see these women all wearing the same clothing and this level of conformity that exists, and there's a certain degree of conformity that's necessary in order to build up the city, as it were. And then you have this stress in the West in individualization, and how that itself has turned into kind of a distraction and a means of increasing production of industry. And that's why I brought up Edward Bernays, is that you have, you know, Bill, you're here talking about public opinion, and then obviously there's public relations, which is the new term for propaganda, right? And obviously he uses conformity as well, like we all eat the same breakfast, right? We have the same idea of what breakfast consists of. It's you know, some bacon or sausage and eggs and toast, you know, and then this is what breakfast is. Okay. And we all share that belief. But then at the same time, there's the whole side of the control of what was going on in the 60s movement of you need to keep industry moving. You need to keep people buying new shit. So you need to its own problem. And so it seems like everything is pushing towards a transcendence of the opposites, because both extremes become ultimately dysfunctional and ultimately end up serving the same end. Though I wouldn't say that across the board industry is wrong. And so I'd like, that would be a conceptual judgment, that is true in certain ways and not true in others. So it's just, you need a balance, I guess.
Yeah, and I think that in the case of the Mayans and of the, particularly these women that all wear the same clothes, that also has something to do with identity, loss of identity.
Right, which is a necessary prerequisite for most cults, right?
So they, you know, they got conquered, and they, you know, they lost their identity. So now, you know, this is one of the ways. And if you look at, for example, the Crips and Bloods wearing colors, right? Or I've dealt with some street urchin people who also, you know, it's a very very rudimentary, beginning, almost primitive way of asserting identity. And it often happens when someone's society or culture has been conquered. That think of the Jews, for example, and the conformity there. Oh yeah. You know, it's a way to maintain identity. Okay, but then it also becomes a way to control people. Mm-hmm. So there's a two-sided aspect to all these things, right? There's a dark and light force at play all the time. So anything could be used, and if your direction is, you know, if your direction, you want to be more toward the light, you can make choices and use all the synchronicity around you and all the items of the present around you and all the information and knowledge you have in the present around you to inform your choice toward the light. But by the same token, you could do it toward the dark too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I like...
One of the things...
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to pose the question, and I don't know if one of you guys has the answer, but, on the dollar bill, Anowis Coeptit, mm-hmm. He favors our undertaking. Mm-hmm. Who is he? Mm-hmm. That's what I want to know. Who is he that favors our undertaking?
Iowa's. I don't know. I think it's a giant spider that runs the Catholic Church.
I think it's a Tasmanian devil, but whatever.
Oh, they're not doing so well. They have disease that's going. We might lose the Tasmanian devil, supposedly. But that's beside the point. that's a really important question, and I think that the answer is probably different depending on who you talk to, and a lot of those people you would talk to would give you one answer and have a different one that they would give you with a secret handshake, you know.
Right. No doubt about it. So good things like in the mind culture, but again, what I'm trying to do is create a connection between what happened with the Mayans and our own society. Not that they're the same, they're not. But there are these similarities that we can see are perhaps universal, which is when you have something, whatever it may be, okay, it may be the concept of the sort of early America concept of the value of the individual, which might have been a very good thing in the beginning, getting turned on its head. Or maybe the concept of a connection to the cosmos that gets turned on its head. So the dark forces are the ones that wish to get you to step in line and, get with the program, or as I like to say, in the 21st century, it's no longer get with the program, it's get programmed.
Mm-hmm.
And all for these reasons that they're going to tell you, which become more and more obviously dark as time goes on.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's really obviously fear. And, I mean, there is a dark thing for you right there. What are you afraid of?
Right. You know, the idea that fear and awe are one and the same, and there's an emphasis that's made in a lot of occultism on reserving one's awe, which is also to reserve one's fear for when something actually comes along that is so much greater than yourself that you have to be in awe of it, and to hold that back, to don't shoot your load too early, so to speak, that there's a time for awe and there's a time for fear, and to put it in its wrong place is a cause for much of life's extra pain, the unnecessary pain.
You're talking about fear and awe, and we're supposed to be in awe of our government in America, especially because of what we accomplished by getting into World War II, supposedly defeating the world's greatest enemy it had ever known, our development of the world's most powerful weapon, and our ability to have kept that power as a sort of chip to at least maintain some sort of peace in the world, albeit, a fucked up piece, but the nuclear apocalypse hasn't happened. But you think of our
right, the Pax America.
Yeah. So like you think of our country, right? And you think of something as seemingly awe-inspiring as universal healthcare, right? That if the American government offered universal healthcare, it would be, what more would you need? If that's a universal right, health, then that would mean the government, if it's subscribing to that, would be behind in an economical and total program directive is that everyone who lives in our country has the right to be healthy. So everything would be designed to make sure that you're healthy. And so it's curious that universal health care is still absent in America, right? Because many countries have it, many countries employ it, and why is our government not employing universal health care? It's a conundrum, right?
It's also going to be viewed by history, right? If we look at different civilizations that have come and gone, we can look at them, and we're talking a lot about the Mayans, and we can talk about, all the wonderful things they had in terms of their knowledge of astronomy and mathematics and all that. And then we can also talk about the negative side, you know, the secrecy and hierarchy and all that. So how is history going to look at us when we had everything? We were the, if you look at 1970, if you go, you know, check out United Nations data or any other data, and you get the year 1970, you will see that the United States is way beyond everyone else in every area, including healthcare. And then you look at it now, and now we're, I forget what, we're not even the top 10.
Yeah, it's
and
bizarre.
That wasn't that long, you know, in years. So how is history going to look at us when, you know, it says, okay, so, you know, they turned into the Romans. They had a lot of military power, and instead of beating their swords into plowshares after World War II, those factories, you know, very prudently from a business point of view, kept making weapons, because it's like, hey, now you want me to change back to making whatever? First you tell me I have to change into making weapons, now you tell me I have to change back. Forget it, I'll just keep making weapons.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what happened. That's what Eisenhower was talking about in his military-industrial complex farewell speech, mm-hmm. because after World War II, they just didn't stop. They just kept manufacturing that stuff like it was still at the height, you know, at the height of World War II. So how is history going to look at us when we had the opportunity, given that we were so far ahead of everyone else at that moment, or, you know, in 1970? That's to me is the apex. In 1970, we had the opportunity. We could have done all these things that history would look back and say, wow, what an enlightened culture. You know, they had, you know, rights of the individual. They had protections of speech and religion. They had protections of privacy and private property. They had universal health care. They had universal education. You know, but instead, what they do is they take some of the good that was in the beginning of our country and our culture, you know, said that, hey, keep the government out of my life. That was in the beginnings, where you had some brave people that were like, you know what, I'll just go out and have my farm, and I'll elect this dude because, you know, it's so far to Washington. We'll send him to Washington, and he'll represent us. And that has all gotten turned on its head, where that the Congress no longer represents people. It represents power.
Right.
And what you said about how we're supposed, what Bill said about how we're supposed to be in awe of the government, to me, that drives me up the wall. Because it's like, no, they are our employees. We all pay for them. They work for us. This is where the United States has been more like, which is a Roman concept of being subject to, as opposed to having the government work for you. You are subject to it.
Right.
And that is a very dangerous thing. That is a very dangerous thing. And there are many, many examples in history of why that is a dangerous thing, including today, if we take the example of China, which, yeah, they flourish and all that, but they put people down and they commit terrible human rights atrocities all the time. And they make sure that the people that are poor stay poor, all this kind of stuff. And they have that attitude, you are subject to. Okay, we are supposed to be citizens, not subjects.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we are subjects.
And this
oh, yeah, this is an experiment.
Yeah, that's what it's become, Bill. That's what it's become. In reality, that's what it's become.
And
we're told that we're supposed to be awe of them.
Well, here's something. Here's the biggest clue for me in the last 60 years about the common person and about love and tough love and human will and decision-making. You know, in 1964, they came out and said cigarettes are bad for you, right? They told you, they said, hey, listen, we live in the greatest country in the world. We have the most affluence. We want to live as long a life as possible. These things that we're using, they're bad for you. And right then, I can't think of a more scary word or a death sentence than the word cancer. And they start attaching this word cancer to this seemingly benign pleasure, this tiny pleasure that we partake in every day. And then by 1969, cigarette advertising on television and radio was banned, right? They just took advertising of it out of television and radio.
In the U.S., but then we still are allowed to advertise it in third world countries.
Absolutely.
Which
but
is
I'm
hilarious.
Just saying, the
you
populace,
see a giant billboard for Marlboro in India.
Like, but the population didn't reject it. the population continued on with it. And even when family members would die of it or get diseases from it, they continued to use the product. You know what I mean? And there's something very bizarre about that. And it says something very distinct about life in the penthouse, right? You are living in the greatest country on the planet. You have some sort of knowledge that things for you are better than anybody or anywhere else, maybe in history, for all you know. And what gives you great pleasure than to smoke 20 sticks of poison, every day?
I'll tell you what, Bill. It's the same thing as the military-industrial complex, and it's for the exact same reasons. So, 2 days ago, me and Amy are on the floor of our house because right outside of our house, there's M16s going off.
I saw that.
Crazy. And so...
I thought you were going to be here too because of that.
Oh, no. It's okay. I mean, we had cops running through our house with M16, SWAT police, and FBI agents, looking under our beds and shit for a suspect that I don't believe they even thought existed. It was just over the top because two cops were killed. They just let them loose, So we had helicopters over our house and this and that. But anyways, right after the shots get fired, Amy, we start a conversation while we're laying on the floor about, she was saying that, we're talking about the death instinct and the pleasure principle in psychology. And, my girlfriend's a psychologist. And so, she was saying the pleasure principle was the life principle. And I was like, I don't remember ever hearing the life principle. And so we pull out Norman O. Brown's. She crawls across the house, pulls out Norman O. Brown's Life Against Death, and we look up the section, and sure enough, she was right, which she usually is in these matters, about the life instinct. But while laying down there, I couldn't help but make a correlation when he's talking about the narcissism and how it relates to our infantile development when we are promorphously perverse because, sexuality isn't just condensed to our lowest chakra, but we're all over the place, like experiencing sexuality and how it gets concentrated later on in life. But I was thinking about the fact that all of our weapons are phallic. They're out there firing guns back and forth. There's nothing more phallic than a fucking gun or a missile or anything like that, or even a rocket to go to the moon, which is interesting that, Jack Parsons designs all the rocket jets and then that ends up working for Project Paperclip to produce, all the missile technology just straight up. NASA and the military-industrial complex are intimately tied. But anyways, the cigarettes is the same thing. You look at the way cigarettes are advertised in Edward Bernays's whole, obsessive trying to emphasize that this is the phallus, and it's an oral fixation. But the fact, what that stems from and how that's connected to our need to build up our ego autonomy and this and that, that's just, it feels to me so direct. And it's interesting that I think it's probably direct to more people than just myself, obviously. Yet the fact that we're aware of it doesn't change the fact that we feed into it. And we can be aware of the military-industrial complex all we want to, but it's still doing what it's doing, even the people who are contributing to it directly. I mean, we're all contributing to it by paying our federal taxes, but at least we're able to, pretend like we don't have to look at that. We just pay, and then we complain about war, It's like, but anyways, that's my
thing. There's a great book that I can recommend everybody, and I wish I remembered the guy's first name, but you guys probably know the book. His last name is Quigley, and the book is called Trembling Hope. Have you guys familiar with this book?
Yeah, I bought that guy. It's big, man.
It's huge, and this ties back to what I was saying. I'm trying to keep a through line here to our conversation. This ties back to what I was saying about the Mayans, the Romans, and various others who had, who flourished and then disappeared. And that there is a cycle, right? There's a cycle that goes on. What Quigley does in Tragedy and Hope is he describes it. And that book out of print. I don't know if you knew that, Bill. That book was pulled out of print.
Really?
And certain elites. Oh yeah, that book's pulled out of print. You can get it online though.
Yeah, I paid like $80 for a copy, man. It was pretty expensive.
Yeah, I think there's a boutique printing house now that's reoffered it. So you can buy it now, but it's going to be expensive, like you said. But what in this book, and it makes me admire the Clash of Civilizations Huntington, because he took it all right out of Quigley, but then warped it. But if you read this book, basically he just describes the cycle that occur with great civilizations that succeed. And if you look, if you read the book, you'll see it's applicable to these various civilizations that we're talking about, including the Mayans, including the Romans, and including our own. The point is, I think also that people are waking up because everyone can see that the emperor has no clothes, because there's such a great distance now between the Bernaysian propaganda we're fed on a daily basis and the reality, that masses of people have woken up. And what I've seen is, in the last 10 years, what happens is they freak out, right? They get all pissed off and because they've been lied to and deceived. But what I want to put forth here is that should be minor.
Right.
Okay. That now, right? So what, it's not just that the emperor has no clothes. It's like, now what do you do now that the emperor has no clothes? And so that is the question on my mind, and also a question that I do not see really being addressed anywhere. But mostly what I see is people talking about the various holes in the Bernaysian propaganda that we are being fed. And of course, we're there. Things like we're talking about, they're always talking about freedom, and yet we're much less free than we used to be. You know, all the obvious contradictions in the I call it a Santa Claus fable that we're being told and taught versus what's going on. What happens after that? So that's where I'm saying this. The whole idea of synchronicity that you guys are, working on is really, a touchstone for a way of looking at the world where one can imbue meaning in the world and forward a way that renders impotent that structure. I was talking before about morality and having a direction and morality as a matter of making choices and in going in the direction that has meaning for you. And what I think we can see also is a tie-in with high mathematics, which has shown us that fly effect. And beginning to understand that the thoughts that we have and the actions that we make actually are significant. Mm-hmm. And what it is it's not this concept that has been promoted since World War II by the elite that say that you should be happy in your position, whatever it is. You know, because if I'm the CEO, I'm going to tell you, if you're the janitor, you ought to, you know, that's important job, you got to do that. That's really, yeah, does so much for you. I mean, it's a way of keeping people down.
Yeah,
it renders that also meaningless.
Well, that's the main objective of the Gita, right? The Bhagavad Gita. Accept your position in the caste system, and then we use the same methodology.
So if you apply both the notion of synchronicity and also if you research into mathematics, you will see that in fact all these things are important. Look at, for example, a couple years ago, I had Jardia. Okay, Jardia is like...
I've had it. I got it in India.
You know, it's a parasite, you know?
Yeah.
And it wreaks havoc.
Oh, yeah.
You know? So the point is that, in fact, and this is borne out by modern mathematics, every little thing out there is significant. That's been proven by mathematics, okay? And mathematics is a wonderful language because it doesn't lie. 1 = 1. I mean, it's not a lie. It's symbolic and all that, but it really is true. And mathematics also precedes the discovery of the reality of it. So Einstein with E equals mc squared before it was proven.
Mm-hmm.
The mathematics are there that show us now the butterfly effect, among other things. And all you have to do is change one little coefficient, and the whole thing changes.
Right.
So, you know, so if you take the concept of synchronicity that we're talking about as being an awareness, an acute awareness of present phenomena, and you take the notion, the sort of existentialist notion, voice and applying meaning and creating a direction in which your life is meaningful, all of a sudden you do need to survive. Yes, you need to eat and sleep and all that. Okay, but you don't need to buy anybody's, you don't need to buy into the Soviet system or the Chinese Central Committee or the caste system or Washington, D.C. or the king or queen in some, you know, working country. You don't need to buy into any of that. You know, and I tend to think of the cetaceans. They're highly intelligent. Science has shown that the bigger your brain is and the more curly cues there are, the more spaghetti twists and turns there are, mm-hmm. in a brain, the more intelligence there is in that creature. And science has discovered that the largest brain with the most curly cues on planet Earth is not the human. It is the orca.
Ah. I've never heard
okay.
of that.
So based on what science and biology have discovered, the orca ought to be who we're communicating with to find out what to do.
Yeah, dig it.
Okay, and of course they have a dark side too. I've seen videos of orcas killing each other, and you know, there's no escaping the dark side. But the fact of the matter is, you know, the cetaceans are highly intelligent, and they're not ruining the world.
Right.
They must do something, you know. And so what I see if we get past the sort of the emperor has no clothes and the sky is falling, which we all probably who are listening to this show have already come to that and are kind of freaked out because, you know, Santa's not coming, right? And the great pumpkin isn't coming. If we can get past that, then maybe we can see that there's a possibility to imbue life with meaning through choices, through mathematics, not throwing away all our knowledge and all that, using our knowledge, using our experience, using the beauty of life, the importance of life, the importance of individual life, whether it is an individual human life or whether it's a cricket or whatever,
mm-hmm.
to not go in and change. See, what I got from the fellow that spurred this whole thing where you're now having me on your show was that, you know, he wants to go, I shouldn't put words in his mouth and he'll probably get pissed off and call me and tell me I'm a liar or whatever. But it seemed to me that he was all pissed off and it's kind of like he wants to go take over so that, you know, we can do it right.
Right.
And I'm saying it will never work.
Right.
The only thing that will work is to actually, I don't want to say validate, because in a way that validates. It's not invalidate. It's to remove. You remove yourself from that whole mechanism,
mm-hmm.
and you work on something else,
right?
Which is why, you know, some of my favorites throughout history have always been artists, right? Because the artists are always the ones just working on their art, you know, and a lot of times they're controlled. Michelangelo hasn't done anything, but mm-hmm. he had to do the Sistine Ceiling, which is an incredible painting, probably the greatest painting I've ever seen, but he had to make it, you know, in line with the Christian myth because he wanted to get paid.
Yeah.
You know, so there's an element of that, but the evolution on a societal level will take a long time. But if individuals just start making different choices about what's important to them, one of the great crimes I think in our society is a misconception about teachers. Okay, teachers get screwed. They get blamed. They get, you know, inundated with tasks that are impossible, like having, you know, 35 8-year-olds in a class or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they're on television is always living in, you know, large houses and beautiful neighborhoods and all this kind of stuff. It's a great crime because the society does not that teaching and learning. You're supposed to know enough to be able to work. Mm-hmm. You're not supposed to actually develop critical thinking abilities, because if you had masses of people with critical thinking abilities, then you might have a major change in the power structure. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's what I see is so important about the whole synchronicity thing, and also our developments in science and mathematics, and also history, back to the Mayans, what we can learn from them about how you can have fantastically advanced astronomy, for example, yet not know what the wheel is.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you can have fantastically advanced astronomy and still collapse.
Right.
So that, you know, that's sort of where I am with that, is that I think we've all kind of realized that Santa is not coming. So now what?
Right. Well, there's collapse and then there's dispersion, right? I mean, you can look at an empire as though it collapsed, just like you can look at a life as though it's ended, when really the energy has been redispersed and redistributed and new forms emerge out of that dispersion.
Right. And you know, normally when that happens, you know, there's a lot of pain and suffering and it's not much fun, right? So I don't want that for my friends and, you know, loved ones. I don't want that.
Sure.
That's why Tragedy and Hope is an amazing book, because there is hope in there also. It doesn't have to collapse. It does have to end eventually, but it doesn't have to be right now.
Right. Well, I have a love for Nietzsche's The Birth of Tragedy and his recognition of tragedy deriving from the Greek meaning goat song, and how it was the satyr chorus above the would sing over the plays that people would gather together to watch, to reinterpret tragedy and give it look at it from another angle, and kind of like the way it's described by Nietzsche is it's like practically like psychedelicizing somebody's relationship to tragedy, so that they can find a reconciliation to the thing, to the appearance. I really appreciate that. I also wanted to just mention really quickly that earlier when you were talking about the Mayans' relationship to sacrifice and how, you know, the off with their heads kind of thing, where some people saw it as an honor and other people it was a punishment, and just this kind of idea of what was going on that you referred to as the darker side, brought to my mind Nietzsche's original, what had the impact on him as a small child, seeing it was a sheep that was being sacrificed by his neighbor, and he watched it in the middle of a lightning storm in the rain, and just saw that because there was no judgment from the person, he could feel the energetic and how it was like it was a perfect act. Though if somebody were to look at it from a place which they would just see as violence, they're like, oh, this is a violent act. But because he was doing it, he was going to eat it. It's there, and it's the child of the man who was killing it is watching it. His neighbor's son is just witnessing this, and he had this insight that affected the rest of his life. You know, I think that there's something to that. That like what it means to be to have mortality. You know, and that birth, growth, decay, and death are a necessary part of that mortality. You know, and to put aside the ideas of morality, there's something beyond that of necessity and what it is to be alive, you know.
And also in The Birth of Tragedy is the all-important Apollonian-Dionysian synthesis.
Right.
That he talks about, right, which is a kind of balance. So the Aymara culture is usually has this concept in spades. Everything is in balance, right? So the mountains are in balance to the lakes, and everything is about balance. And so this is something that it's a bit out of wacky, Western order, okay? And I see it as also out of whack in places like Russia and China as well, where we lose a sense of balance in life, part of which is the notion of mortality, So I see all these Americans, and I have friends that are like this, that, well, you know, emails, you know, such and such is bad for you. It'll give you strokes or whatever, you know, and it's like, what, you can live forever? You know, be happy with what you have and live a life that's full, so that at any moment, if death is coming for you, you can say, okay, you know, I've had a good life. Because you are going to die. And talk about fate and destiny, there's the proof. I always tell people that say, oh, there's no such thing as fate. I say, go to a cemetery. You know, I mean, there are some things that are fated to happen because they are part of the cycle where we started this whole conversation. You know, they're part of the cycle. So part of the cycle is birth, growth, decay, and death. That's the cycle. Mm-hmm. I'm concerned because I'm getting a bit older, and my brain is slowing down. I have more knowledge, and I have a better ability to put it into context and to put it in perspective than I did 20 or 30 years ago. But I'll tell you what, 30 years ago, my brain was way faster than it is now.
Mm.
You know, so I'm worried that I'm coming to these things, too late, maybe, to really make use of them. But on the end, I'm glad that I have reached the point where I'm having these insights. And frankly, they put me at odds with people all the time. People are not willing to be insecure. People are not willing to be afraid. People are not willing to discover. People are not willing to explore. Here I am in Peru, and I see all these tourists, and they're not exploring. You know, there's a whole group of European tourists who come, to Peru and Bolivia to do coke.
Oh yeah.
And to and to go out to clubs at night, and basically to live the life they live in Europe.
Uh-huh.
And you know what they do all day? They sleep all day. You know, they never see anything except, you know, they go out and they meet their other, you know, European friends, the ones they came with, the ones that are all traveling, and they're all, you know, having fun together, and they meet for dinner, and then they go out and party all night. And you know what? Might as well be in Berlin, Amsterdam.
Have conversations about how hard it is to find a decent hamburger or something.
And then I see Americans, okay, Americans come here, and they're not so much about the nightlife and partying. They're more about owning the listing, right? They tell them, you know, I got to see this. I got to, you know, I got to do Machu Picchu, and I got to do this, and I got to, you know, Lake Titicaca, and I got to take that tour, and then I got to, you know, I got to go to do this, and then I got to go to Atacama Desert, and I got, you know, and it's like while they're doing it, they're snapping pictures. And it's like, this is one of the lessons I learned from using some photos, because I've traveled a lot, but in recent years, it was either studying with shamans in Guatemala, where I was in one place, or I was in Europe, which is more or less the same as North America. And it's been a long time since I've actually been in motion. I wanted to be in motion on this trip, but making a tour where I'm actually exploring. And so, again, that experience was really pivotal for me, because now I'm exploring again. I want to explore and talk to people. In order to do that, you have to leave the cave. You have to leave behind the things you know. You have to leave behind your preconceptions, and you have to explore.
Right.
You know, you explore to find out whatever there is to find out, not to, you know. I used to work in high-end data analysis, and this is the little anecdote that I would always tell people about analyzing large volumes of data. What we do in America all the time is we say, there's a needle in that stack, find it. Mm. That all the time, they've already determined what the outcome is supposed to be before it happens. So, okay, what's going to happen is the average Joe, let's say there are two giant haystacks, okay? Both of them have a needle in there somewhere. Okay, so what the average Joe is going to do is he's going to go do just what Big Brother told him and go find that needle as fast as possible and get back quicker and win.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but what I'm hoping to do, and I may do or may not do, is I'm going to go in that haystack, and you know what? There might be a pot of gold in that haystack somewhere. But if all you're doing is looking for a needle, you're never going to see that pot of gold.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's, to me, what exploration is you have to decide your desired outcome before you can actually explore.
Right, or you might find a pile of shit that can be turned into gold in the Jodorowsky sense. You know?
Right, sure. And also, I think of great people. Some of them have been very brave revolutionaries. Some of them have been very brave thinkers or artists. Some of them have been actually spiritual people. You might call them saints or whatever, but they're great people who actually put aside one of the core fears, right, which is the fear of death. They'll actually put that aside, be like, whatever. I am doing this, and I'm going to die anyway. So if I die doing this now, then I die doing this now. Mm-hmm. And those people have long-reaching. Think of Martin Luther King. Think of there are lots of examples that you can come up with. Mm-hmm. And those are the real explorers, the real discoverers, the people that have left the comfort of the couch and the flat screen. And the dogma that goes with it. We have an increasing dogma in our new religion, which is science. So half our population are, claiming the apocalypse is imminent.
Yeah.
And and then another half, maybe my half and half is maybe wrong, but large group of our population is waiting the imminent apocalypse. Another large portion of the population says, no, all that's dumb, and science has already figured this all out, and that isn't possible, and this isn't possible, and that isn't possible. And I'm sitting there thinking, you know what? You're just as dogmatic as they are.
Sure.
So, yeah.
I think you and I had a discussion at one point, the difference between martyrdom and what Martin Luther King and Mahatma Gandhi and a number of others have done. Which is like a martyr is somebody who actually basically wants to die for their cause, whereas these people were people who were like, I'm going to do whatever I need to do in order to get what I believe has to get out, and if I happen to die in the process, so be it. And right. There's a okay. distinction cool. to be made there.
Same. Yeah, good. True, good distinction, So Gandhi or Martin Luther King is not a, suicide bomber.
Right.
Because, again, there's somebody who is supposedly committing a moral act in order to be rewarded later.
Right. Go ahead.
What I'm learning, too late in life, but what I'm learning is actually the nature of good, if I can use that word, if it hasn't completely by burning propaganda, the nature of goodness is that it is good in and of itself. So a person does something good because it is good, not because of some consequence later.
Right. If consequences dictate my course of action, then it's only wrong if you get caught.
That's what I was talking about with regard to some of the Native Americans that I've seen helping each other with no possible hope of any compensation for any notoriety from it, anything, in complete absurdity, just because that's what you do.
Yeah,
because goodness is goodness in and of itself, and you do goodness because it's good, not because you need it to get where you're going or whatever.
Yeah, Amy had shown me a book that she had been meaning for me to look at that I had initial resistance to, called Learned Optimism, and it's legit. It's this guy with a PhD who talks about how to teach yourself optimism. And it's, if you know me, you can understand why I might have resistance to this. And so, I rely on my pessimistic view sometimes in order to feel like I'm not necessarily just, burying my head in the sand. And, but one of the things that he talks about in this book that he, was, ended up being acknowledged, within the, psychology community, was that he ran experiments to show why the behaviorists were wrong in their assessment of assuming that human beings responded primarily through reward and punishment to any given situation. That they believed that that was the prime motivator in their action. And first he started with dogs, and then there was a man in somewhere in Asia who had basically ran an experiment to show that it was true with humans as well. And I don't recall the specifics of his experiment, but I could, you know, get that for anybody interested. But Learned Optimism is the name of the book. I can't remember the author, but it really blew me away because it was for real. Like, and this is an assumption that people have, is that people's prime motivator is there a reward possible. And when it comes down to it, that's not necessarily the case. That is secondary when it comes to our ultimate decision, which is, I mean, that's a significant thing. And I can understand why that would offend a lot of people who are really like invested in that idea.
I have another thing that I learned recently that I want to pass on as well, which comes from some psychological research, which is something cognitive behavioral therapy.
Yeah, same thing.
So
yeah.
what happened to me and what I've seen happen to a lot of other people, I was lucky because it happened to me a lot sooner than it happened to other people. And the reason it happened sooner with me was because, A, I knew people that died in the World Trade Center, and B, I was living abroad at the time and I was able to look back at our country outside. But what happened was I got very depressed when I found out Santa was not coming. I got very depressed. And then I did a lot of research. I found out a lot of things, like what a lot of your listenership is bitching about, right? The deceptions that are going on. The emperor that has no clothes, all this kind of stuff. So they're waking up and they realize Santa isn't coming. And they're pissed off. Okay, now here's where the cognitive behavioral therapy comes in. So we have patterns of thinking. Now, you can do research and you can find out a lot of things about our society that are very depressing. And guess what? They're all true. Now what do you do? What a lot of people do is they run around saying the sky's falling, or they get pissed off and they want to expose Dick Cheney or whatever it is. You know, but they're just full of anger, you know, because they've been deceived. But what good does that do them? So in the end, what happens is that there's a pattern of negative thinking based in truth. Okay, and they get caught into that. Now, how do you get out of that? Well, the fact of the matter is, for, you know, the light, dark, positive, negative, male, female, day, night, nature of our world, there are also many good and beautiful things out there as well. So again, the way it seems, the best way to deal with evil is to remove yourself from it. And so even though that all those ideas that make up that pattern of thing that a person might be caught in, maybe they're all true. But at the same time, there's something else that's true over there that they're not seeing. That pot of gold that's in the stack, that needle that they're looking for. David, before you do that, let me just finish that thought I'm working on. I don't know how much of it you got, but I can reduce it now because I had 3 minutes to make it clearer and conciser in my mind. Okay, so everybody's pissed off. They realize the emperor has no clothes, and they're trapped in a true negative pattern of. Okay, and this is what I see going on a mass scale of people that actually have critical thinking abilities and have woken up, if as it were. And what I'm saying is, what I'm discovering is, then what do you do next? That's what I was saying is that, okay, so the emperor has no clothes and so on. What do you do now? You got to get away from being pissed off because that does you no good. You end up just getting, you know, some pissed off. So what do you do? And I think the answer is that there are all kinds of other possibilities out there, such as that story I said I put forth about maybe pot in that haystack in addition to a needle. In other words, there are a lot of other things out there that may be wonderful and beautiful and positive, And so the way to deal with evil is to remove yourself from it. In other words, if you want to take over Washington and to make sure that'll never work, what you have to do is you have to remove yourself. I'm not talking about, you know, emigrating or what have you. I'm just saying on a sort of daily basis that you remove yourself from that situation because you know Santa ain't coming. Mm-hmm. So, you know, why would you hang out with all the people that are telling you Santa's coming any day now? Because you know Santa is not coming. And then you go and you do other things and you set your direction and you determine your meaning and you use your critical thinking abilities and you definitely use your synchronicity and your awareness of the present and the significance of the coincidence of meaningful things to determine a direction and then you move forward from there. And I think in that there is a lot of hope for a lot of people. Because people are, you know, still have a lot to offer. They have a lot of creativity. They can do lots of things, and it doesn't just have to be the end of the world and the end of, you know, America and all that. That to me is ridiculous. So, what I would advise to people that are upset because the emperor has no clothes and because Santa isn't coming and because the Bernaysian propaganda is full of holes and everybody can see it who has any critical thinking ability at all. Is to go ahead and move on from that. And understanding that those things are true, yes, you spend your time and you analyze it and you determine, yes, these things are true. It really does suck. And then put that aside, move on to something else.
Dig it. So there's the two different ideas of acceptance, to passively put up with something and to do nothing about it. Or to recognize the situation one's in, and in the midst of that, to do what one can to change the situation. And what you're saying is, when you're in the, you kind of have to extract yourself from the game of it in order to actually have something to offer that can allow for a significant change that's not simply cosmetic. You have to liberate yourself from the dysfunction before anything can really be offered that's not just simply the same thing in new clothing. Does that...
That's what I'm saying is my personal insight. I'm not saying that's the only insight. I'm not saying that's the only thing that can be done. I'm saying that that's what I've discovered for myself.
Okay. It's funny, you keep saying that the emperor has no clothes. Since my... last study session with the rabbi, we really focusing on this term Aram, Aram. I believe it's with an ion. So I don't. But basically, the term that's used in Genesis for the serpent, where the serpent is naked. It says that. Well, okay. So the same word that's used for Adam and Eve were naked and were not ashamed is the same word that's used for the serpent was the most cunning of all the creatures in the garden. And the verses are side by side. And so this has been a point that I've meditated on quite a bit. But the idea that for something to be exposed is the flip side of it being hidden. And for something to be hidden requires like an energetic of like cunningness or deceptiveness. But that the thing that's hidden is itself of a deceptive nature simply because of the fact that it's elusive. Right, it's not easily shown. Yet at the same time, it's in plain sight, and so there's a paradox of something being in plain sight, yet the plain sight being the best place to hide something simultaneously. And so, in the last art piece that I just put together, the last collage work I did, I put the Hebrew term Aram at the top of the image, expressing, you know, like the idea that the stone that the builders rejected is the capstone. The stone that they've rejected is taken as a reference to the Shekhinah, which is the keystone of the archway. So if you have an archway, everything is dependent on this keystone. And the idea that the keystone, which is the most repressed and most hidden thing, is also the thing that's in the most plain sight. It's also the most obvious thing. And so it's like to build what we're building requires a degree of self-deception. And so I would say that the first step to liberating oneself from this pyramid structure is to recognize what is most obvious and what is simultaneously most hidden, as contradictory as that may seem, I think that there's something to it.
I like it. I can add to that, but if you want to do your closing now, then I can add to it after your closing.
Go ahead. We should be okay.
Let's say everyone's caught up in this cultivation of corn in the Mayan Grand Classical Age, shortly before the first collapse. Okay, and they can see that the society is getting oversaturated. That, you know, like you said, it's obvious, right? Like I keep saying, the emperor has no clothes. So the Bernician propaganda no longer works on everybody. So what do? Well, hell, I can just, you know, I can take my family and we'll hike, you know, 100 miles in that direction, and we'll start a farm there, and then we'll grow corn. I mean, it doesn't have, you know, by this, you're saying that sometimes the problem is obvious, like the keystone, and sometimes the solution may be a very simple, natural thing. It doesn't have to be some great creation, some great machination. It can just be a simple thing. Ball with you anymore. I don't like this ball game, so I'm not playing ball with you anymore. I will go somewhere else and do something else. You know, it doesn't have to be, you know, I hear so many people that have woken up and are in that negative circular pattern thinking based in truth, who are so upset. It's like, why do you have to be so upset? Just go do something else with your life. You know, go do something beautiful, or what you think is beautiful, good. And, it just move on.
Yep. I love it. Do you have anything to add, Bill?
You know, one thing that has been kind of dancing in my head is you mentioned Santa Claus. And I mean, I'm thinking 100 years from now, how will we explain to people what Santa Claus was? Or will we have to explain to people what Santa Claus was? And just how much those two words will be able to encompass so much of what the world is that we live in. And how amazing a phenomenon that is. And just as amazing is what will replace it. And who will be the architect of the thing that replaces the void when Santa Claus leaves the building? And I think that's the real role of I think, in my opinion, awakened artists should be working on. Because one thing's a fact is that if we're all here in 100 years from now, there will be children, and those children will be looking for something to start building a foundation on. And for whatever reason, myths, gods, angels, demons seem to be the substance of childhood evolution. So I don't know. It's just a weird thing, because if you mention Santa Claus in the village that you're in right now, Alex, how many people know exactly what you're talking about? I mean,
right, exactly. They're not on that wavelength.
But now you mentioned Quetzalcoatl, and I'm on that wavelength, and I maybe shouldn't be living in the Midwest in, you know, America circa 2013, but I can grasp Quetzalcoatl and its Aztec, resonance and how that plays out. I don't know what I'm really saying by that, but I would say this, that in my position in the world, in space and time, I think that I don't know the reasons, but the reasons, the fact that I can have a cognitive impression of what Santa Claus is and what Quetzalcoatl is, that there's got to be some importance to that. Yeah. Right? There's got to be an achievement there.
Right.
That we folded space and time, we folded the paper so that those two words can dance in my brain and I can start to make sense of just what that means. So, I'm not going to retreat from my position is what I'm saying, right? You know, I'm not going to run away from the drama of Santa Claus and Quetzalcoatl. I'm going to stick around and try to figure that fucker out. And both are seemingly imaginary beings. It's just bizarre. It's very bizarre.
I think it's a really good point to bring up because oftentimes I mention people that be careful about what we replace any dominant paradigm with. Because as a society, because if you look at our modern secular society, right? I'm talking about the West now, right? Europe and North America. So over the last couple hundred years, there has been a replacement of the predominant model from although you know it's not like a black and white thing; they overlap, and certainly predominant model that predated the current model still has a great deal of power, but it seems that we've moved in the secular direction, and so in a way, I'm not saying that I'm an adherent to the old model. I'm not, but there was a positive side of that model as well. There was a whole lot of negatives that we know about, about control and all that stuff. But there was also a positive side that had to do with hope and faith and stuff like that. So you can. What have we done in essence? We need to get rid of that, which is probably a good idea. But what do we replace it with? We didn't replace it with enlightenment. We replaced it with stuff. So we threw out hope and faith and replaced it with rampant materialism. But the point is, it's not always easy to get a societal model that works. And so when I say I might just go off and do something else, that doesn't mean I'm running away. It means I'm running to. I'm going to something else that's better than Santa. Now, on the Quetzalcoatl side, I think there's something really important there, and we've heard a lot about it, and it's wonderful. Rachel Carson was a wonderful thing. Environmental movement is a wonderful thing. But the point is that now I live in the woods in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and because my better half and I have been in New York and Washington, D.C. and Amsterdam forever, and we looked at each other one day and we're like, what's missing? And the answer was nature. And the fact is that we're all creatures of nature. And somewhere along the line, Western civilization, its desire to conquer the forest, did. And its desire to conquer the atom, did. You know, and these are our great achievements. But along with that goes the hubris, where people have forgotten how to live. And I know friends, I have friends in L.A., for example, who would be dead in, 3 weeks if they had to, grow something or somehow be connected to nature. You know, they do as much as they can to be not connected to nature. And so one of the things that I think is a good and positive direction that I see, although oftentimes it is bastardized and mutilated and mangled into something ugly, but in its core basis, I think it is a very good thing, which is to remember nature and to remember that all these things are alive. And maybe some of them are even than we are, for the orca. So I see that as one positive thing that's going on. I also see it as something that can be a negative too, because there's a coercion element in there as well. Again, there has to be balance. But I don't have the answer. I admire you for wanting to stick to your guns, but I fear you may be in the Alamo. But I admire that. on the other hand, I want to reiterate that I'm not running away. I'm just going to something else. That's not running away.
You know, I see in your comments that, and I understand how you heard that and what I was saying. And I didn't intend to communicate something along that line about your personal journey of being somehow an escape or a distancing, because I don't think that at all.
Right. I just don't want listeners to get that.
Exactly. Exactly.
I don't want listeners to get that.
I think what I'm trying to establish is that the status of the culture in that village, there's something that one, like you said, you can embrace it for its simplicity in the face of a no-win situation, but there's also an argument that, I don't know, that's just such a huge concept right there, is the argument of simplicity in the face of a no-win situation is honorable, or is it an unwillingness to fight for what is great about living or life? And I don't really know how I feel about that at this point, and I can't even speak to it right now in the context of this conversation. But
or it could be seen as stupidity, too. A lot of people look at it as stupidity.
But there was this curious moment during our conversation where at the beginning I felt your position on the globe as being distinctly in the village, right? That our conversation started with you in that village, and somewhere in the middle, I completely forgot that you were in that village in a cafe utilizing the one source of internet that was, you know, located where there wouldn't be located miles and miles away. Like somewhere in the middle of that conversation, you were no longer in Peru. You know what I mean? That you were in this other space. And you're the only person in that cafe who could have entered that space with us. And that seemingly is the human technology, with the right perspective, is that we are privileged to be able to activate that kind of ability. And that speaks to that keystone, that hidden, deceptive technology, because it's something that shouldn't be played with by novices, right? It's complicated and it's very advanced, and you need to advance very far to even be able to recognize it or to lay your hands upon it. And so, I don't know, just a lot of stuff swirling in my head right now.
I would just like to say really quickly that information does not equal knowledge or understanding. And that the distribution of information doesn't always imply that beings are intelligent because they have access to said information. I mean, and the fact that in a lot of these, you know, we talk about the mystery schools and stuff, and a lot of these places, people had to work up to the point where they were given certain information. Yet now we live in such a way that at the press of a button, boom, there it is. But that doesn't imply understanding. That doesn't imply that people are able to receive the information. That's why, you know, like with Kabbalah means to receive, but I mean, to have something transmitted and to really digest the meaning of something is not something that's automatic. That's something that requires practice and patience and all of these things that we look at as virtues, you know.
You know, it's like this dream.
Just going to say, intelligence also doesn't equal wisdom.
Right.
Agreed.
So, you know, another thing I wanted to say is we must not throw out the baby with the bathwater as well, because there are many things, and I think, Bill, you touched on this, there are many things in our culture right now that are very positive. Okay, my better half does a lot of work with children that is very positive, and much of it is paid for by our tax dollars, the same dollars that pay for the nukes. And I've been all over Latin America, and I've run into, you know, DEA agents in the middle of the jungle in the Amazon. Nowhere. I mean, that guy must be really pissed off. That's the American equivalent of sending someone to Siberia, you know. you pissed us off, you're going down to the Amazon. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I mean, there's tons of dark stuff going on, but there's also good stuff, because as I travel around Latin America, every I see a school or a bridge that's got USAID on it, I think, oh, well, what a wonderful thing. And I also know it's a whacked. Every time you whack someone, they balance it. They're not stupid. So they whack someone and then they balance it by building a school. You know, they whack someone over here and they build a bridge. But the point is that there are also good things going on. And I think, Bill, you alluded to our technology, you know, scientific knowledge and all that. I'm not a Luddite, I don't advocate, and I think that this is a mistake that I see a lot of people making. Just because you get back in touch with nature doesn't mean you get rid of electricity.
Right.
You know, I mean, I think we need to keep the good things, and I think at the end of the Roman Empire, I think monks off to Ireland, because that was the furthest place away they could get. And what they did is they took all the books with them. You know, and as a result of that, Aristotle survived.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, I think this is an important point. I think, Bill, you've got some, you know, you're on the right track there. You know, we need to keep the things that are good, and we need to recognize that are not good, dangerous as being such. You know, we have to be able to discern between the two, and that's difficult to do. Like David was saying, you know, just you have to be, you know, whatever, seventh echelon before you can get information. But I think there are a lot of good things we have in our society. There are a lot of good people working for the government. There are lots of good things going on, and we don't have to throw those out. But at the same time, that doesn't mean we have to stick around and play this ball game. You are subject, and you are part of the Pax Americana, whether you want to be or not, and you validate yourself as part of that. You better prove you're part of that. who needs that, really? I mean, is that what life is about, really? So, you know, I think that's the challenge I see, is to sort of get the wheat from the chaff somehow, to understand, like, okay, this is something that's good. For example, you mentioned the ability for us to talk. I'm in Peru, you're somewhere in the Midwest, David's in California.
He's in Chicago, actually.
Oh, Chi-Town.
Chi-Town,
but anyway, you know, but I had great food in Chicago. You know, good eating there.
We know
but,
how to eat.
But anyway, yeah, I mean, you know, it's a valid point, and it's a wonderful thing. And at the same time, Skype is owned by Microsoft, and my research into current surveillance is that it's run way amok. There's a good chance this is being monitored. That's not a guarantee that it is, but there's a good chance that it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's like a waste of time, you know. Don't these guys have something important to do? You know, why are they listening to us, you know, talk about metaphysics?
Mm.
You know, so it's like everywhere you go, they take something incredible like Skype and they turn it into a surveillance tool. So just understanding that is the beginning of the ability to be able to separate the wheat from the chaff. So in other words, Skype is a good thing. The internet's a good thing. Surveillance of private citizens who are talking about peaceful things is not a good thing. And so I think as people wake up, I think, Bill, you got an excellent tack there, which is, okay, we've woken up. Let's get away from the negative pattern thinking, because that's not productive. And you're saying, okay, I'm going to hang out in the Alamo and we're going to make it. I'm saying maybe I'll walk off to Ireland. In the basement. In the back room. I'll be in the back room where all the deals are made. Okay, so I'm going to walk off to Ireland, and you're going to hang tough in the basement. You know, those are both perfect things to do. I think what I'm saying here is that to be able to separate the wheat from the chaff is an important thing. We don't end up getting rid of much that is good in what we've already made, you know, because it's not all bad at all.
Mm. Well, this might be a good note to kind of transition here. I know, Bill, you have something you need to...
Yeah, I got a scoop.
Get to.
But okay. This was a wonderful afternoon. It was great to be introduced to you and to talk to you, Alex. I really enjoyed it.
And Bill. I appreciate it. And again, like I said before, I mean, you're the only person who's ever given me an interpretation of Finnegan's Wake that I'm like, what the hell? How come I saw that? You know, there are Ivy League professors who've spent their entire life trying to figure out that book.
It's a doozy.
And you seem to have figured it out.
Well, there's a lot of great people talking about that fucker right now. I think there's a resurgence. There's a new generation turning their eyes to it because they're looking for something with the momentum of thought going on. And a lot of signs are pointing back to that book and to what Joyce was trying to accomplish. And I think people are really finding a lot of satisfaction spending time with it. And who knows? Who knows?
Anyway, that was amazing. And I also think you had a lot of good points. You had good points about public opinion and you know, this last point that you made also, I think, is, you know, so I'm really pleased to have made your acquaintance. I'm glad we talked. I hope it's useful. I hope we can put it in your program.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe we'll talk again sometime.
Oh, absolutely. That's a definite. I definitely would look forward to speaking with you again. And I'm sure David and Alan Green would love to spend time. And I'm sure he would be here if he could, but he's got some slave labor thing going on or something.
Yeah, we have a normal co-host who's actually the man who put this show together. Alan, Alan could be here, but maybe at some future point you guys can have a conversation.
Well, I hope he listens to it and enjoys it. And David, I know I'll see you sometime, although I hardly see you anymore, but I know I'll see you sometime.
Yep.
Back there at home.
Cool.
And
yeah.
By the way, the poster turned out great. Bill, David did my last album cover, and he did a really great job with it, and then he made a poster as well to go with it.
You have to send me that, David.
Sure.
Got it. And I can give you the link to the album if you want to listen to it.
Yeah, no, that'd be great, Alex.
The album. I'll type it in here for you.
Cool.
But that's what I do. I'm not traveling and thinking and philosophizing and exploring. I write music. And it's just my own. It's all me. Whatever. If you listen to the album, the whole thing is me. I played every note. I produced it. I did everything on it. It's all instrumental. Anyway, I'm sending you the link here.
It's the only way to go.
There you go.
Badass. I liked it. I like it.
BohemianGroove.com. Awesome. Well, have a good day, Alex.
Okay, you too.
Okay, bye.
All right, adios.
Bye.